I don't know how we're going to get it all in. We almost have too much show. While other radio programs stretch out their ingredients to try to cover an entire 4 hours, we have too much show. We should lend a cup of show to the competitors just to be charitable. And what a great show it'll be. I'm looking forward to our guest next hour, Dr. Bernard Haish. You may have heard him before on Coast to Coast, but I don't think you've ever heard him like this. Coming up next hour, he's German-born American astrophysicist, PhD from University of Wisconsin, and a professor of founder of various important labs and, research stuff. It's so far above my People magazine level understanding of science that I'm really looking forward to this, mostly because of the work that he's done on three things which I find fascinating. The principle of inertia, which he says could lead us to all new propulsion systems. The God theory that he has. The God theory was the most recent book that he published, in which he can take a science-believing human and be able to convince them of the existence of a divine using purely scientific reasoning and principles. What kind of God? That's not the question. The question is just that there is a divine. And we'll get into that coming up next hour. And of course, his very interesting work on UFOs and a website that he maintains. All of this ties together very nicely for a guy which I know will be a great guest coming up next hour, Bernard Haish on Coast to Coast, but that's just part of the show. Captain Kelly Sweeney is back. He's tracking the maritime news of this missing ship, which was found, or was it? This ship that had been boarded by pirates in the North Sea, had been lost somewhere around the cliffs of Dover, had been presumed lost somewhere out in the ocean, and now has been found, or is it? And why? Has this ship, how could it have ever vanished off the face of the earth? We'll talk about that with Captain Kelly Sweeney, who knows a little bit about that, a little bit later on this half hour. And then, if you ever heard the mystery of the founders of the Gallo Wine Empire, that it was mob connected. And I say mob, I mean Al Capone connected. And that very likely, one of the earliest founders of the Gallo Wine Empire was actually murdered by Al Capone. It's a fascinating story, which may be verified for the first time ever, coming up a little bit later on this hour on Coast to Coast AM. How about a little crypto news to get your night started? You don't want to miss this. We've got important news about about UFOs in Washington, about white noise and red salmon, and then the hardest thing I can ever imagine myself doing. How about you? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, I hope you had a chance to catch the Perseid meteor shower earlier this week. I was catching a little bit of George earlier in the week while I was on vacation for a couple of days. I was away from all light pollution. I hope you had a chance to do that. Get in a comfortable place, not too many mosquitoes around. That's what I did. I was staying for a couple of days at a lodge in the middle of a lake, in the middle of the woods, lying on the grass with my teenagers just for about an hour, watching one shooting star after another. The only light around was from the campfire about 50 feet away, and only when the smoke wasn't enough to keep away the skeeters did we go back inside. It was magical. It was amazing. But as cool as they were, those lights were nothing compared to what families saw in Lake Liberty, Washington. This story is linked at coasttocoastam.com. Several families are looking for answers after they saw strange lights in the night sky Wednesday that they swear were signs of a UFO. This, according to KXLY TV. Amateur video shot from the scene shows strange lights in the nighttime sky moving erratically, changing in both color and size. And it wasn't just one or two people who saw the lights. Up to a dozen members of several families say they saw the same thing. Now they're trying to figure out exactly what they saw. I like how the reporter writes this for KXLY. These are normal people from a normal neighborhood. Editorializes the writer as though the rest of us are abnormal or something who see these things. But anyway, they say that what they saw last night in the skies southeast of Liberty Lake was anything but normal. It started about 8:45 Wednesday evening when they saw two lights far above the horizon, one white and one green, and they weren't moving in concert with each other. One person described their movement, said it was left to right, up and down, hide behind the cloud, then come out. After about an hour, the green light eventually took off slowly, then fast, and then the white light started acting up after the green light left, getting bigger and then smaller. An hour after the green light vanished from view, the white light moved across the sky and went north, and it stayed stationary. Then it changed all kinds of different colors, like red, blue, green, and then disappeared over the horizon. What has been confirmed is that Fairchild Air Force Base nearby reports that they had no aircraft of any kind in the area Wednesday night. I think we'll have to ask Bernard Haish about that coming up next hour. From white lights to white spiders, this story in Discovery News, an enormous system of caves, chambers, and tunnels lies hidden beneath the pyramids of Giza, according to a British explorer who claims to have found the lost underworld of the pharaohs. Populated by bats and venomous spiders, the underground complex was found in the limestone bedrock beneath the pyramid field at Giza. Quote, there is untouched archaeology down there, as well as a delicate ecosystem that includes colonies of bats and a species of spider, which we have tentatively identified as the White Widow. That, according to British explorer Andrew Collins. That link is also up on the webpage. By White Widow, I don't mean Scarlett Johansson in Iron Man 2. Oh, wait, I guess she's Black Widow, right? The mysterious new Stark Industries employee with that famed widow's bite. I was just trying to work in a cheap way to plug a movie I'm excited about. I'm going to have to wait until May 7th, 2010 for Iron Man 2. But news are just, I'll put up a link on my blog for news about the film. It's going to be very cool. And I never had a chance to see District 9 so far this weekend, but I'm going to try and get to it tomorrow. That looks also a lot of fun for comic book fans. If you're bitten by a White Widow spider, perhaps some white tea might help. Next time you're making a nice cup of tea, new research shows it might be wise to opt for a white tea if you want to reduce your risk of cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, or even just age-associated wrinkles. The researchers were blown away by exactly how well the white tea had performed. We were testing very small amounts, far less than you would find in a drink, said the scientist. The early indicators are that white tea reduces the risk of inflammation, which is characteristic of rheumatoid arthritis and some cancers, as well as wrinkles. That from physorg.com. That's great news if you're not only old, but you're old and wrinkly. And from the mystery of white lights, white widows, white tea to red salmon, millions of sockeye salmon have disappeared mysteriously from a river on Canada's Pacific coast that was once known as the world's most fertile spawning ground for sockeye. Up to 10.6 million bright red sockeye salmon were expected to return to spawn this summer on the Fraser River, which empties into the Pacific Ocean near Vancouver, B.C. The latest estimates say fewer than 1 million have returned. That's a tenth. The Canadian government has closed the river to commercial and recreational sockeye fishing for the third straight year, hitting the livelihood of nearby Indian reserves. Quote, it's quite the shocking drop. That with the Salmon Society nearby, no one's exactly sure what happened to these fish. Several theories have been put forward to try to explain the sockeye's disappearance, including the climate change that may have reduced food supply for salmon in the ocean, or that they have been infected with sea lice en route to the Fraser River. That's one more thing I didn't need to worry about. Sea lice. Another theory is that the rising temperature of the river may have weakened the fish. There may be another explanation on that. too. I'll put up on my blog here a photo from a friend of mine who was up shooting pictures of grizzlies in Alaska. And he caught a shot of a grizzly pulling a red salmon right out of the river. It's pretty amazing. And that's pretty good for my friend Joey, who's a notoriously bad runner. He's pretty brave to be that close to grizzlies and their food, especially because he was covered in heavy camera equipment. But he got these really cool shots, and I'll put a couple of links up on my blog. In an endurance race between grizzlies and the participants of the Badwater Ultra Marathon, however, my money's on the runners. Did you see the CNN story? The Badwater Ultra Marathon is infamous in endurance sports circles. It is the running equivalent of summiting Mount Everest, the ultimate test of mental fortitude, and literally with the highest highs and lows in any race. The race starts at 280 feet below sea level, the lowest point in the Western Hemisphere, and covers three mountain ranges for descents and ascents, totaling 9,000 feet, and ends halfway up Mount Whitney, the highest point in the contiguous United States. Now, for all of the non-sweaters out there, the CNN reporter writes, consider how long it takes to drive from Baltimore to New York. From Baltimore to New York. Now imagine running that distance without sleep, with 10,000 blow dryers pointed at you the entire time. That's the Badwater Ultra Marathon. And what do you get if you should finish? If you finish in less than 48 hours of what they call Satan's Fun Run, you get a thick silver belt buckle. That's what you get. Marshall Ulrich, a 58-year-old endurance sensei, who has done Badwater more than a dozen times, and by the way, has also summited Everest, said, to talk about the belt buckle is to miss the point. This is coming from a guy who is notorious for having his toenails surgically removed because they fall off anyway when you're an endurance runner. So Marshall says that you can't think about the belt buckle. It's not about that. It's about getting off your butt. He said, you run Badwater because there's something in you that wants to get out there in the middle of nowhere and think about something. No, dude, that's why you run Badwater. If I want to think about something, I go to a coffee shop. And if I'm out in the middle of nowhere and I want to think about something, I make some coffee and then I listen to Coast to Coast. That's what I do. Amazing kudos to you. We'll put up a couple of links for the Badwater Ultra Marathon on the blog, and I'll get to that coming up later on after we get a break at the bottom of the hour. And then we'll find out more about whether it's true, the murder mystery of whether or not Al Capone killed one of the founders of the Gallo wine fortune. And it's a very interesting story. We think about, you know, Ernest and Giulio Gallo, and it's all very... You know, it's all kind of first generation, cool immigrant success story in America. Yeah, well, you know, they may have had a lot more to do with in common with the Kennedys. It seems like it's entirely possible that the Gallo fortune was built on felonies of one type or another. And we'll get to that coming up a little bit later on Coast to Coast. But first, the missing merchant ship. The Arctic Sea had last been sighted in the Bay of Biscay on July 30th. This was the merchant ship with 15 Russian crew members. The Russian Navy had been out searching for this 4,000-ton vessel, which had been supposedly carrying timber. But now observers have said that maybe the ship was hijacked, maybe it had a secret cargo, and maybe they have found it 400 miles off the coast of Africa. Let's bring in our friend Captain Kelly Sweeney, who tracks stories like this for us all the time on Coast to Coast. Captain Kelly, good evening.
Good evening, Ian. It's great being with you. Ahoy to you and all the Coast listeners. And I'm here to shed some light on this Arctic Sea mystery. And, man, what a mystery
good.
It is.
Well, we count on that. And I know that I talked to you earlier in the week and you'd gotten emails from other captains and there'd been a lot of scuttlebutt going around about this ship. Tell us, what do we know about this missing ship and the possibility of a secret crew or whether or not it had been hijacked? What do we know?
Well, here's what I've concluded and from what I've gathered. First of all, I originally thought the ship might have sunk. Maybe a rogue wave, or maybe there was a stability problem in the bottom of Davy Jones' locker. But if that were the case, there would have been an EPIRB signal. And an EPIRB is an emergency beacon that on a cargo ship is made that floats free to the surface and sends out a distress signal that's picked up by authorities, gives the name of the ship and the location of the beacon, and authorities use it, rescue authorities like the Coast Guard use it, to pick up survivors. Well, that did not happen, and there was no report of that. So, I think the ship was hijacked, and I believe personally that it's a good likelihood that part of the crew was involved.
Okay, now that's an interesting theory. We know that at one point the ship had been boarded in the North Sea, right? Somewhere around off the coast of Sweden.
Well, there's some speculation on what happened, and yet these guys came on board and posing as Swedish authorities,
right,
attacked the vessel and all that.
Supposedly attacked the vessel, then left.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, on board a ship like that, there's what's called a global distress, what we call a hotkey. It's a red button. There's one in the captain's office in the equipment down there. There's one up on the bridge, and there's one in the radio room or whatever serves as a radio room. And if the ship were boarded and were in imminent danger, not only from piracy but from anything, the officer on watch or the captain would just have to hit that key, and within seconds there'd be a distress that would go to the authorities, Coast Guard authorities, up and down the coast of Europe. And that did not happen.
Okay. But didn't they also get it? Didn't they get ransom demands? Didn't the people who own the ship, the Finnish company that owns the ship, didn't they get a ransom demand?
Well, that's what they said. Yes, that's
okay.
What they said. Now, you know, we're talking a small ship here. Okay, it's only the size of a football field, which, as cargo ships go, is very small. 98 meters, about 315 feet, and we're talking timber, lumber. Okay, we're not talking a high value cargo here. So my feeling is there was something else on board, some kind of contraband, because a couple weeks before, the ship was getting repairs in Kaliningrad, Russia, which is a known haven for smugglers and all kinds of illegal activities of a maritime nature.
Right.
It's a very famous place for that. So I think there was some kind of contraband on board, and I think if the authorities are going to want to find this ship, I think it's going to be in one of two places. It's either going to be off the coast, either of Europe or Africa, outside the shipping lanes in the eastern Atlantic, and the contraband already taken off. Whatever part of the crew was not involved and was not complicitous with this hijacking, shot and killed, and the ship left adrift. Or there were unverified sightings off the coast of France, then later off the coast of Portugal further south, and then later, recently, off of Cape Verde. Of course, nobody's actually been aboard the ship and seen the ship in person.
Right. They're just saying,
yeah, we saw a ship that looked like it.
Right.
Okay, now, so I think that, you know, the west coast of Africa, there are so many havens for smuggling and for all kinds of illegal activities, piracy along the west coast of Africa. I think it's very likely it's either off the coast or it's in a coastal port, an undisclosed port that's a haven for smugglers and pirates.
All right, now I got to ask you a question, and this is not specifically about this ship, but give me the top three contraband cargoes that could have resulted in this act of piracy.
Well, I mean, I think drugs comes right up as one possibility. Some kind of trade secret, perhaps, or something maybe even a little more sinister in nature.
Like weaponry?
Yeah, like weaponry. I mean, there's been Chinese ships and other Russian ships that have claimed on the cargo manifest to have nothing like that on board. You and I talked about one not too long ago that, you know, had off the coast of Hawaii that broke down, had all kinds of weaponry on board that weren't disclosed. I think that's very okay. possible.
Well, that's where we'll leave it for now. We'll ask you to keep track of that story. Perhaps we'll hear you in the meantime during the week on Coast to Coast. If not, we'll catch up with you next week. And thanks for staying on top of that. Smooth sailing to you, Captain Kelly.
Thank you, my friend.
I appreciate that. Nice to have a guy who's got contacts like that. So we'll get you the latest on that when the latest is available on Coast to Coast. And speaking of mysteries like that, we'll uncork the mystery of the Gallo Wine Empire in just a moment. And then Dr. Bernard Haish is back, one of the smartest men in the world. And he'll explain his God theory. And we'll start off by talking about that UFO report. How would he explain something like that as an astrophysicist? Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. You know, here it is, 40 years since Woodstock, and still the impact is felt from that amazing, magical weekend. More magical for some people than others, of course. There was a little bit of pixie dust going around. It's been fun to hear the music again, see some of the concert performances. If you've never really sat down with it, you really should. I mean, the recordings of Woodstock aren't that great. I read recently that had it not been for the film that was made of it, though, of course, the producers of Woodstock would have totally lost their shirt. But because they happened to have it on film and a decent soundtrack had come of it, they were able to make all their money back, plus more. And you know, I don't know how you feel about it. I don't think you have to do drugs in order to enjoy music like that. It also has been kind of fun to hear a lot of the interviews with people involved with Woodstock who did a lot of drugs that weekend who don't do them anymore. Just basically, you know, there was a time and there was a place and they're over that now. Now, I guess, like a lot of people, like I am tonight, I had a good bowl of Golden Leaf tobacco before I came on the air tonight, and that's about as hard as it gets for this show. But then again, you don't need to do drugs if you're doing interviews with Dr. Bernard Haish coming up next hour, astrophysicist, PhD from University of Wisconsin, who is a well-known principle of inertia, controversial theorist. And if you don't know about that, you're going to want to hear about that. If you don't know about his God theory, we'll get into that coming up. But we'll start by talking about that UFO story at the beginning of the hour. If you miss crypto news, it's online right now at coasttocoastam.com. I put it up on my blog with some great links. A couple of photos from my friend Joe, who just got back from Alaska shooting grizzly bears with a camera. And you might want to take a look at that at coasttocoastam.com. Going back in history to the founding of the Ernest and Julio Gallo wine fortune, like a lot of great American fortunes, somehow at one point or another, there's an illegal act. Isn't that what they always say? Show me a great American fortune, and I'll show you an ancient felony behind it. We'll get to that coming up next. Something I swear I'd never heard of next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, if there is a theme to Jerome Tuccelli's writing, it's probably that he's fascinated with powerful men and powerful companies. Would that be fair to say, Jerome?
Yeah, I've written books about Donald Trump, Rupert Murdoch, Alan Greenspan, and now the Gallo family. So I'm fascinated by these people.
I think that's way cool. You also did that book on Barry Diller?
Yeah, Dillerland, which came out earlier this year.
So Gallo Be Thy Name is the new book. Is it out on shelves?
It will be in a week or two. It's selling now on Amazon.
Okay. And people can link up to that at coasttocoastam.com and grab a copy of that. Gallo Be Thy Name. This is less perhaps about any one person, but sort of the biography of the Gallo wine fortune.
It is. It's basically a history. It's a true crime story as well as a biography. It goes back to the early days of the last century, early 1900s. It takes us through Prohibition, the aftermath of Prohibition, and the Gallos, people don't realize that, are sitting on top of the the biggest wine dynasty, the most powerful and richest wine company in the world. They've got annual revenues of about $3.5 billion.
Wow.
And they created this through a combination of, toughness, shrewdness, an element of crime in the early days, and genius, too. Ernest, a lot of people portrayed his dark side, and he was a tough guy, but he was also a genius and a visionary who saw the direction that the American tastes were going into after Prohibition. So,
I'll save part of that for people who want to pick up a copy of the book. I want to focus on the crime aspect because it's something I just never heard of. I mean, Ernest and Julio Gallo, we've seen them on commercials for years, and I had no idea that the Gallo family was at one time, or at least somebody in the Gallo family was considered the Al Capone of the West Coast.
Yeah, Ernest and Julio's Uncle Mike was called a West Coast Al Capone. Ernest and Julio have always they wrote a book whitewashing their own background, but they were making wine in California before Prohibition, and they were running wine to Chicago, to the Capone mob, throughout Prohibition. And some people might say that they were doing a public service by doing that, but they did have connections to the Capone mob. And Ernest actually went there when he was in high school and associated with them, and pretty much admitted that he carried a pistol to protect himself at different times.
Well, you know, I was reminded of the image in the movie The Untouchables with Kevin Costner, where they were stopping the wine coming down to Chicago to Al Capone by having to go up to Canada and cutting off the pipeline from Canada. Where was the pipeline from the West Coast to California? How did it get to Chicago? In reality, how did that wine get to Al Capone?
Well, it was on railroad tankers. they admitted that they grew grapes.
Right.
It was legal to send grapes, but the grapes were an advanced stage of fermentation, you might say. It was called vine glow, and it was practically ready to be bottled as wine. So by the time it got to Chicago and also went to New Jersey, to Newark, which was a big center, to the mobs there on the East Coast, it was wine at that point.
So basically they were using the train cars as giant fermenting vats.
Exactly, yeah. They were big tanker cars, and they filled them up with, many, many gallons of wine and supplied the markets there.
Okay, so did they have to have vintners involved in the transport of the wine from the West Coast to Chicago or to Newark? Did they have to have people along the way that were testing the acidity of the wine and how it was fermenting from almost wine when they put it in the train cars to wine by the time they got to Chicago?
Well, yes. Joseph Gallo was Ernest and Julio's father. He was a vintner, and he used to make the runs to Chicago. And then he really was intimidated by the Capone mob, and he sent Ernest, his son, who was at least as tough as he was, and even as a junior and a senior in high school. So Ernest was the vintner aboard, and the Ernest and Julio said they started making wine after Prohibition, but they read a pamphlet and learned all about it, which is nonsense.
Of course,
the family had been making wine for 20 years at that point,
and they must have been profiting enormously and off the books without paying any income tax on it to be supplying wine to Al Capone at that level.
Well, it was all cash transactions, obviously.
Right.
Al Capone was not taking checks from anybody.
Right. So, I mean, or writing them for that matter. So what are we, how much money are we talking about, do you think, to be made during Prohibition supplying wine to bootleggers like Al Capone?
Well, they were making many thousands of dollars. Back then, that was a lot of money, and they had enough of the stake in cash to get started after Prohibition as serious vintners when it was legal. And the Sebastianis and the Mondavi clans had already been well established before Prohibition, and they had enough to get started with their own. They inherited from their father underground tanks of wine. They was smart enough, Ernest and Julio's parents, to anticipate that Prohibition would not last forever, and they actually dug underground tanks, fitted them out, and had rivers of wine in there, ready to go as soon as Prohibition was over.
I'll be darned. And so that would have been illegal, right? They were supposed to have poured out all the wine into the gutters or whatever.
Well, yeah, the only wine that was given a pass, so to speak, was sacramental wine. So there was a great increase in sacramental wine drinking, you might say,
right,
during that period.
Right. Now, very interesting. Thank you. So who got murdered, and how did this play into the building of the Ernest and Julio Gallo fortune?
Well, in June 1933, just as Prohibition was ending, the father of Ernest and Julio, Joseph, and his wife Susie, their bodies were found on their ranch in Fresno. Now, the police investigated this, and they pretty much covered up what happened. They put it down officially as a murder-suicide. You know, father goes crazy, shoots his wife, and then shoots himself. It didn't really happen that way. What happened was they were in debt to the mob, the West Coast mobs based in Oakland and San Francisco. And I interviewed the son of the man who found the bodies. He's still alive. He's in his late 80s now. And not only were the bodies found, but the two dogs on the farm were shot to death. And there was a check for their property taxes in the mailman to be picked up the next day. Now, if you're going to shoot your wife and kill yourself, you don't shoot your dogs, too. I mean, hitmen would do that because they don't want the dogs to bark and come at them.
Right.
And you don't pay your tax bill
the
night before you're going to die.
No.
So it's clear to me the circumstantial evidence points that it was a mob hit.
Did the police try to claim that the two dogs' death were a murder-suicide, too, that one dog shot the other dog and then shot itself?
That never made the papers.
It could have been the nice police work, Lou. All right, so then again, we're talking with Jerome Tuccelli, who's the author of this new book called Gallo Be Thy Name, a biography of the Gallo Wine Empire. So then who do we think, then, murdered Ernest and Julio Gallo's parents?
I spoke to some Gallo family members who say they owed money to the wrong people. They were definitely tied in with the West Coast mob, which was affiliated with Capone. And the uncle that I mentioned, Mike Gallo, their uncle was actually spent time in San Quentin. I mean, he was involved in all kinds of bunco games and extortion rackets and other activities before Prohibition. So he was a pretty notorious figure on the West Coast. And so there was definitely that mob tie, and it had all the earmarks of a mob hit, no question about it.
Okay, but why, if they're valuable to the mob and they can provide all this wine, and the Gallo family was already cooperating with the Capone mob to supply them with all of that wine, I would think they would be more valuable alive than dead. And if they were in debt to the mob, why couldn't the debt just be more easily paid with a couple of truckloads of wine?
Well, they had competition, too, from Mondavi and Sebastiani and the others and the Franzia family, whom the Gallos married into. Ernest married one of the sisters, the daughters there, rather. And so, you know, there was competition there. They had suppliers all over. And Ernest had a couple of run-ins with Capone, and he rubbed them the wrong way at different times. And so there was a vendetta element involved there, too, retaliation.
Could it be that Al Capone approved of the murder of the founder of the Ernest and Julio Gallo fortune?
At one time, he threatened Ernest's life. He said, if Ernest shows his face in Chicago again, we're going to get him. We're going to take him out. So Ernest knew that there was a contract out on him. He was not a fearful man. He actually went to Chicago with his wife at one point, and he hid from the Capone mob, but he made his presence felt out there.
Huh.
And so he was, as I said, he was a bit of a thug. He was also very tough and very smart. As I said, he had a genius element to him too, which a lot of people have overlooked.
Well,
create an empire.
No. like that without having brains. In fact, I mean, that's a big empire. As you say, that's the biggest wine empire. And it comes, at least it intersects it through the Prohibition and to Al Capone. Now, I made the statement earlier that, you know, people have said, you know, show me a great American fortune and I'll show you somebody who was linked to an ancient felony. In all the work that you've done writing about very rich people and the ways in which they made their money, do you think that's true, that most of the mega rich at some point or another had to commit some sort of crime to get where they are today?
Well, there's either that element or sometimes it's using the political system to one's own advantage. The Gallows certainly did that as well. I mean, later on, they gave money, large sums of money, to both the Democrats and the Republicans. They were big contributors to the Clinton campaign. And then when Bob Dole complained that they were getting favorable tax treatment, they started shoveling money into Bob Dole's coffers. And so they were playing both sides of the fence. And you'll find that with people like Donald Trump and Murdoch and the rest of them, if there's not a crime in the background, it's certainly a lot of political favoritism.
Right, which may be bordering on criminal, but not quite there yet. Well, very interesting. And thank you, Jerome Tuccelli. I think this is a very interesting book. I like what you that you wrote this book about Alan Greenspan called Alan Shrugged, the world's most powerful banker. Do you think would Alan Greenspan be doing better with the economy right now if he were back in power?
Oh, I don't think so. I think Greenspan had a really good track record up until about 2002. Let's say 1999, 2000. He's a case of a man who just hung around too long. If he had quit back then and didn't really take part in the Bush administration, I think he would have gone down better. But I think he's somewhat responsible for what happened, this economic collapse that we've had recently. And I don't think he'd be doing any better than anybody else is right now. I think he's a very confused man right now. And
What do you mean by that?
Well, he gave a testimony before Congress, and he says he was shocked that the marketplace didn't self-correct. He believes in laissez-faire capitalism, and he thought it would be self-correcting mechanism. He didn't realize that bad regulation, of which he was a part of throughout the 90s and early 2000, really brought on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all the subprime loans that were the beginning of this. And okay. He was in there with that.
I'm loving your work here, Jerome Tuccelli. I'll have to take a look at the true story of the Hunts of Texas. The book is Kingdom. Is that it?
Yeah.
About H.L. Hunt?
H.L. Hunt and his sons Bunker and Lamar, who tried to corner the silver market. Well, not Lamar, but Herbert and Bunker did back in 1981.
Again, kind of making a fortune by committing crimes. I mean, or at least flirting with it like that.
H.L. Hunt himself was essentially a degenerate gambler who finally made so much money that he couldn't gamble it away anymore.
Nice problem to have.
yeah, it was. And he said that he didn't do it for the money. I mean, he was a man who drove 10-year-old Chevrolets and wore mismatching suits and carried his own lunch to work. But he said it was just money was just his way of keeping score, his way of letting the public know who was smarter, that he was smarter than anybody else.
Lamar Hunt always seemed like an interesting character. So I've always been sort of fascinated with him. So I'll have to take a look at your books, and people can link up to Jerome Tuccelli through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. Again, the new book is called Gallo Be Thy Name, a biography of the Gallo wine empire and its roots in Prohibition. You can get it now online at Amazon. And thank you, Jerome. Really appreciate it. God bless you. Have a great night.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
That's really interesting. And coming up, I want to get to Bernard Haish. You need to know about Bernard Haish. He's an astrophysicist of the highest order. He was the founder of something which I can't even pronounce, and it's in English. And he's been doing work in particle physics, in quantum vacuum theory, the principles of inertia, He has more than 100 research papers on a variety of topics. He's been published everywhere. He even served for 10 years as the editor of the Astrophysical Journal. Now, that having been said, his book that's been out for a little while is called The God Theory, in which he writes, "I offer a genuine insight into how you can and should be a rational, science-believing human being and at the same time know that you are also an immortal, spiritual being, a spark of God." Now, that's from him, Mr. Uber Scientist. He proposes a worldview that offers a way out of the hate and fear-driven violence engulfing the planet. And he's also the host of a UFO skeptic website. So I got to ask him about the latest sighting we talked about earlier on Coast to Coast AM next. This is Ian Punnett.